Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gib.
We have emails, right?
Yeah, I got one right here from Chris. Quitting smoking is a great New Year's resolution. This is in reference to something I said. You weren't here when Yulia Vergine was in studio, sitting in the seat you're sitting right now. I told her that I was going to quit smoking.
It's we're in the, well, more than past the middle of January. Are you holding true to that New Year's resolution?
No, not at all. Sorry.
Did you even start?
I tried for 4 days, and that worked because my wife, like I said, remember when I said I was watching all that TV?
Yeah.
She was not there, and coincidentally, when she's not there, I don't smoke. Right? So
I was gonna say subtly. It's not very subtle. You're blaming her for your nicotine addiction.
All right. Chris wrote in, quitting smoking is a great New Year's resolution. That said, it didn't work for me. So the resolution bit. Anger did. I smoked from the 1970s until the tobacco companies were sued. The amounts of money were astronomical. Smoking cessation strategies should have been free and available to anyone wanting to quit, but all that happened was tobacco became really, really expensive. This made me furious. I determined I would never give another dime of my money to that habit. I'm happy to say I've not smoked since that time. I'm happy that health concerns did not force me to quit, but I'm ashamed that the knowledge of them wasn't sufficient in and of itself to make me quit. I'm sure that if you think about it long and deeply enough, this is his message to me.
Mm-hmm.
If I think about it long and deeply enough, I will also come to the conclusion that it's a pretty ridiculous habit and that will only cause me trouble the longer that I continue. That's not enough for me, Chris. I'll have to search for something else that works, but I'm in the process. I haven't given up the resolution. I haven't thrown in the old proverbial towel, but at the moment it's on ice. It's cold outside. So.
Well, speaking of ice, you play, well, I guess, roller hockey. Maybe like a positive association between the better or the less I smoke, or if I stop smoking, my lungs will feel better and I'll play better. Something. Yeah, you do probably need a mental trick, something to focus on to get away from it.
We'll keep you posted.
Another email. And this time from Bolivia. It's been a while since we got an email from Bolivia. It's a longer one from Ernesto, and I won't read all of it, but it's connected to this HMPV viral outbreak in China, which that kind of tells you the whole story already. When you hear viral outbreak China, people get very scared now because of what happened in
Wuhan.
In Wuhan, yeah, 2019, 2020, 2021, 2020, going on to now, the COVID-19 pandemic. So because we have this, we've been imprinted that way, anytime we hear about an outbreak there, we tend to feel very alarmed. Could this be the next pandemic?
Mm-hmm.
And that is what happened throughout the world. And in fact, HMPV is really very much a common cold. And just like other seasonal colds, wherever you live, sometimes it's a really bad season.
Mm-hmm.
You usually hear this from teachers or anyone who works with a lot of children. Like, oh my gosh, everyone's sick right now. That's what's going on there. And Ernesto's email was effectively saying, look, I started seeing these very alarming screenshots and memes and videos online that made it seem like this was going to become the next pandemic. And even though I went to DW.com and read your article about how it's not that, there was no reference to the fake information, to the alarmist information. And this was in connection to this fact-checking stuff that we talked about last time.
And the fake information that was circulating the web was that it had crossed borders through the world, become a pandemic already, or that it was worse than it actually is in China, or
what I saw, and I'm referencing here a Reuters fact-checking news piece,
yeah,
against social media. Companies are no longer doing this themselves. It's all being outsourced. Luckily, we still have news agencies out there doing it. They linked to a couple of social media posts and videos. One appeared to be a digital-only newscast from India that was alarmist in nature. It makes it appear, I'm not sure where they got their footage, it makes it appear that the, or it suggests that hospitals are full or mm-hmm. over. You know, it just echoes of the COVID-19 pandemic, and that's unfortunate, and it's incorrect. That is not what's happening there. And you're right, Ernesto, though the references to the alarmist information or the overblown information was not in the original article. I'll talk to the author and see if maybe we update that at some point. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna get into some science, some hard science.
Oh,
you got some too? Hard. Well,
mine's
yeah.
not hard.
It's not. Yeah, I don't know what I'm saying.
I'll be talking about sports. So.
Okay, then we'll start with mine. This one, I'll keep it short. The sort of provocative title that the authors of this piece were allowed to publish in the New York Times, which I found interesting. It was sort of a summary of what they had researched over at Harvard, is the quote-unquote hack that doctors should take from pop stars and quarterbacks. That's kind of, you know, gets your attention. Wait, there's a hack that doctors should take on?
From, what kind of doctors?
From pop stars? And right. Long story short, it's that if a quarterback, an NFL, American football quarterback is about to walk on the field, or a pop star is about to go on stage, they have a professional voice trainer or quarterback trainer with them just before the start of the event to take a look at what they're doing. You know, look, cut last couple adjustments right before you go out on the big field and or on the stage and do your thing. Why don't doctors?
Oh, so right before they go into for a procedure, for a surgery.
Who's checking up on them?
Yeah.
And in particular, apparently studies in
the— Don't forget this one technique before you go in and do brain surgery.
Hey, real quick, let's do a quick rehearsal. Yeah. Let me watch it. Yeah. So there have been studies in the past that was in one of the links within this particular study that if a doctor, I mean, all of us, if we go on vacation for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks and then come back, you're kind of rusty at first when you get back. You make some small errors. Gabe, in our job, it's not life or death. In the medical field, it can be. And so in this particular study, they took a look at 150 anesthesiology trainees, so young people going through medical training of some kind, at 10 in 10 different programs. That was important for them. And what they wanted to see is there a difference if you divide that group into two? And in one group, they go in and they do their anesthesiological, not training, but practice on babies in this case, under the age of 12 months or younger. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're supervised. These are trainees. They're not going in and doing it on their own. So the one group does it with the supervision of a doctor. The other, they get coached beforehand with a mannequin. And so the doctors watch it. Look, you're about to go in there. Let's just test it.
This is exactly what you're going to do in a minute.
Yeah.
But let's do it first on this mannequin.
Let me just watch you real quick.
Yeah.
And there was a pretty significant difference. The most important criteria, or one of the most important criteria, when you're intubating an infant in this case for an anesthesiological procedure is whether that tube goes down their throat the very first time. And that first attempt success rate in the group that was coached beforehand was 91%. In the group that was not coached and just kind of went out and did it under supervision, it was 81%. So there's an immediate 10% jump. And I think all of us, when we imagine, I unfortunately clicked into a YouTube tutorial on how to intubate a baby as part of my research for this.
What?
I think you need a lot of exposure to that kind of medical videography before it becomes normal and you can stop screaming, I don't know, and trying to like jump out of your chair.
Well, looking at any infant on an operating table, it doesn't matter what's happening. That just, it almost hurts to look at because of all of the associations and imagery that's already in our head to begin with.
Yeah, but right? I think all of you out there can agree, let's do that right. So if I'm an 88-year-old man and something goes medically wrong and it doesn't go perfectly during the operation, that's fine. Yeah. If it's a 7-month-old child, let's get that right. That's what these authors are saying. If you're going to do it on a stage or on an NFL field, let's do it in a pretty boring-looking, nondescript hospital there, and everywhere.
And the tip for people listening to the radios right now is if you have a difficult task, it's not a bad idea to do a practice run.
And have someone
beforehand.
Have someone be humble.
Hey, can you check this out quick? See if I'm spreading the peanut butter correctly on this white bread here.
Yeah, whoever your superior is, it's hard to acknowledge that. Oops, I've gotten worse after a vacation or a break. Or oops, I need that. And to even ask someone for their time. But that's the tip for you, especially if it's sort of a high risk. It could be a situation. It could be a presentation that you have to give. It could be anything. Yeah. Ask your superior or someone who's been doing it consistently for months to watch you do it just beforehand.
Every single golf shot I ever took, I did a practice swing before it.
Mm-hmm. But right? Imagine if you had a coach watching you.
If I had a coach. Let's stick with sports. That segue happened. I didn't even try for that.
Wow. Pulling one.
This is my day. elite athletes, elite soccer players. What sets them apart from non-elite soccer players? What do you think? What's off the top of your head?
I would say a couple things. Partly it's got to be genetic. There are people I've played against who can run faster than me, and I will not be able to train up to catch them. Mm-hmm. And the other part is that I think there's a certain type of mind.
There's
a certain type of mind.
You're getting hot.
Okay, where when you realize where you're weak, and the more specific the better, the kind of cutback with the outside of this one foot in a certain situation, and then you practice just that. Mm.
You're getting real hot.
Am I? I don't even know the study.
Okay. Researchers in Denmark, in Italy, in England, in Sweden, in Brazil, looked at the psychological profile of the elite athlete. They wanted to see if there's something in the brain that sets elite athletes, or at least elite soccer players, apart from non-elite ones, and they found it. Not only in the personality issue that you met, or aspects that you mentioned there, but also just in cognitive abilities. So they are better. They looked at 200 soccer players in the top Brazilian leagues and Swedish leagues, and then compared them to controls. So 124 controls and 200 some elite soccer players.
Best of the best.
Their brains, the elite soccer players, were better at executive controls, decision making, planning, being able to see things, cognitive flexibility. They're just smarter and way smarter.
I find that fascinating, because that goes against the cliche that I think most lay people would have watching these athletes. These are impulsive, aggressive beasts.
Yeah.
Right? Just running around and doing things, where in fact they are. Yeah, there's a lot going on up top.
I was hoping when I asked you what sets an elite athlete apart that you would say only physical characteristics, because that's my gut feeling would be they are bigger, faster, better at physical things. This study found that in the brain, at least, it's really important. Their cognitive abilities, far and away better, but also their personalities were way different than the personalities of the 124 people who were just normal. They were way more conscientious, and that means that they're willing to go that extra mile to get better. You said if there's something that you're not good at, I always think about Tiger Woods. If there was any part of his golf game that he wasn't the best at, then he spent crazy hours and time and effort into making that part better. The conscientiousness, his conscientiousness was off the charts.
Well, and then, see, you think of Tiger Woods and golf, and I tend to go away from sports to music, where I believe I saw the most similar study. I'm not even sure I looked into it, but it was the same. It posed the same question. So what, if you're trying to learn a new song, at some point you and I are going to say, that's good enough. That's close enough. Now, there's somebody else who might ultimately become a professional musician who would seek perfection and possibly attain it. Mm-hmm. And now you're getting back into human biology, because that is a functionally a different brain that doesn't accept or is willing to just keep going and going on the one minor mistake and fix it till they fix it, till it's okay.
Think about if we're trying to learn a song and there's this one, this F sharp minor 9-7 chord that really hurts your pinky to play it. You might not play it with that ninth note because then the pain goes away in your pinky. So you are less conscientious. And another personality trait that was different here was that the elite athletes were less agreeable. They're less agreeable people. They're willing to do their own thing. Go the extra mile to become better at something. And I'm not willing to go that extra mile, which is why when I play a song, it sounds okay.
Well,
as opposed to an elite musician where it sounds perfect. It's the brains that are different. So if you're wondering why you didn't make it as a professional athlete, if that's keeping you up at night and making you smoke, it's just your brain.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're the kind of man who gets bothered by pain in his pinky, then that's going to change a lot of things. No, it gives you some empathy for the coaches, right? If social cohesion is not as important as doing your own thing all the time, that's tough. The cast of characters keep together.
And one last thing, it helps out for scouts, because now in the future, you're just going to have to give these elite athletes an IQ test and a personality test, and then they can see, there's the next Ronaldo.
Oh, I see. So you're looking at brains rather than
look at brains instead
brawn.
Instead of looking at, I don't know, how fast you run the 50-yard dash in.
Well, I think you still have to look at speed. Otherwise, you might have a brainiac out there who can't run. Last thing I'll say here as we enter for the United, this is a very U.S.-centric message, but has global implications as the U.S. Inaugurates its next president. I've seen anecdotally a lot of commentary online, people who are exhausted by the news cycle. It feels like it's been, ever since going back to the COVID-19 pandemic, and even before that, just more and more and more news grabbing your attention all the time, overwhelming you, distressing you quite a bit.
Oh, having an absolutely negative impact on your well-being.
Yeah. And so I took a look very, very quickly, because I kind of with an agenda, I was convinced that I would find a study that said if you consume more news, you're going to be unhappier. And in fact, that wasn't just my agenda. It was the thesis or the theory of some Spanish researchers who looked at into this during the COVID-19 pandemic, because they had not a control group. They had the before and the during the pandemic. Before the pandemic, people were consuming X amount of news. The pandemic happened. What happened to all of us? Tons of news, tons of digital streaming videos, films, etc. Like all of our media consumption went up. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting is they did not find that more news consumption made people unhappier. What
effect did it have?
That stayed neutral. I mean, I could get into the numbers. It was news, and in particular, the one that really not only didn't have a negative effect, it had a slight positive effect, and this is so self-serving for me to say this, it was radio. So all of you listening to this on the radio...
I mean, listen to it twice, on repeat.
Yeah, go for it. Well, it kind of makes some sense. Does listening to the radio for a little too long, does it make me unhappy? Sometimes you get tired of the noise, but that didn't have much of an effect. It was watching too much entertainment, kind of like your binge weekend. After a while, that drops you off.
Addiction thing plays in, because if you feel addicted, you feel trapped. You're like a slave to the. You can't control it.
Right.
Of course, that has to have a negative impact on your well-being.
And the other thing was changes in the use of social networking sites that had the. If I'm looking at the numbers here, the biggest by far the biggest drop off in people's well-being, or not by far. That and the change in the amount of TV series and movies that you watch. Those were the two. So I was actually quite shocked. It wasn't the news. But what the authors in this paper end up arguing, and if you want to look it up, it's called The Exploratory Study of the Relationship Between Happiness and the Rise of Media Consumption During the COVID-19 Confinement in Frontiers in Psychology, is that just kind of keep an eye on or trust your own gut. Do you start to get that feeling like, blech? It's too much. It's too much. It's too much. Trust that. Cut yourself off.
You have stopped using those social media sites. How are you doing?
I like it. I feel better. I feel happier. I go back and check them sometimes just because, and sometimes it's for the wrong reason. And it's to give one example, you can read about wildfires in Los Angeles, or you can be confronted with, bombarded with video imagery of them.
Yeah.
Now, which one makes your body feel more alarmed and like things are out of control and doesn't really give you the context and which one...
Or watching a 40-second clip of Joe Rogan saying that they spent $24 billion on the homeless last year and $0 helping these people protect their homes. That... I don't know how to deal with that. But if I read an astute analysis, then I'm probably going to feel better. You have been way more friendly and agreeable lately, so...
Thank you so much for that, Gabriel Bord. How do you see things as we enter another period of lots of headlines? Where are you at? How are you doing? Have you changed anything this year? Any tips for Gabe to stop smoking? Let us know all of those things.
SUDW.com. One in four women who have just given birth suffer postpartum depression, mental health issues following the birth of the child.
That is a huge
one in four
number. And if we rewind back in time, I believe postpartum depression for a long time was euphemistically packaged as the quote unquote
baby blues.
Baby blues.
God, do I hate that term.
Right, because what that. Soft language does is it makes something that is very serious kind of unserious and that you just go through. And so it's very helpful now that we talk about it as what it is. Yeah. Postpartum depression, postpartum symptoms. We're at the point where we're talking about women that way. Should we also be at the point where we're talking about men in the same way?
Yeah, research has come out that 1 in 10. So 1 in 4, obviously, this is primarily, first and foremost, a problem that affects women. But 1 in 10 men clinically show symptoms that would say that they're dealing with depression, anxiety, mental health issues following the birth of their first child. And we're going to talk about that today with somebody who has studied this, looking into what kinds of men suffer this, what can predict whether you will suffer it. He's looking at the population of Australia. He's Ed O'Connor. He's a really interesting guy, and we're going to head down under now.
Science Unscripted.
Hi, I'm Ed.
I am a mental health researcher and a firefighter here in South Australia, and we just finished doing a study looking at depression in new fathers.
And before we jump into the study or talk about anything else, you are a mental health researcher and a firefighter? How does that work?
Well, I suppose it's a bit of a long and winding road. My background's in psychology. So I studied psych, but I suppose being a father played a huge part in my decision to leave academia and take up what here is viewed as a really highly skilled and highly respected profession as a firefighter. So, I've only recently made the switch and I'm loving it so far. In fact, I'm still doing a little bit of research too, which is great.
Let's go to that research or your new study. If you've got 10 men and all 10 are going to have a baby, then one of those men over the next 12 months is going to suffer from depression, from depressive symptoms. What are we looking for? How can we identify or figure out who of the 10 men that one guy is?
Well, when we're trying to identify that guy, basically we're looking at that person's lifetime history of mental ill health. So their levels of depression, so their symptoms prior to the birth of the child, but then also their lifetime history. So have they ever had a diagnosis of an anxiety or a depressive disorder?
Yeah, so if my mental well-being is not good before my child is born, does it become worse after that kid is born? Or what happens?
If your mental well-being is poorer prior to having a child, then you have higher risk of experiencing depression once your child comes along. And this makes sense from the perspective that becoming a dad is a huge stressor in your life. It requires so many different changes that you have to cope with, places demands on you in ways that you've probably never experienced before. And so that can be really difficult to cope with and can, resurface old mental health wounds, for lack of a better word.
How would you explain to someone who says, look, you have to suck it up? This is normal. This is what happens when you become a father. You have to deal with responsibility. For somebody who knows now a lot about what men go through in this transition from not being a father to being a father, how would you explain that to a person who doesn't understand it?
Yeah, look, I think it's such an interesting point to reflect on, especially in culture around the world at the moment. There's sort of, it feels like this pendulum is sort of swinging between, masculinity, what aspects of traditional masculinity might actually be protective and what are causing more problems. And I think personally on that level, there's strength in vulnerability and there's resilience in connection with other people and there's a lot of personal growth to be made from being authentic about the experiences that you're having and, how your behavior is affecting other people as well. And so, in answer to that question, I don't think sucking it up and keeping it to yourself is a really helpful response.
Gabe and I both know someone who recently came to talk to us because he's thinking about becoming a father. It was actually, it was really like meaningful to even have that conversation at all and to have someone come to us for advice. Based on what you know, Ed, what's the best thing specifically with regard to avoiding or hopefully preventing depressive symptoms, the nastiest potential outcomes for a father directly after having kids? What's the best advice we could give him?
Oh, well, that's a big question. I think the best advice for our study would be to seek help to get your existing depressive symptoms, well, to understand what's going on in your mental health right now and to get some support in whatever way that looks like to reduce your symptoms. But also the novel element of our study was that you shouldn't just focus on, okay, what's wrong with me right now and how can I be less bad? But seeking out opportunities to actually boost your well-being. So feeling more connected to other people, investing in your relationships, finding that level of satisfaction and gratitude with your life. These sort of more positive elements of mental health, if we can improve those as well prior to becoming a man, that recipe, high well-being, low symptoms, is really what sets you off on a course for having a successful transition to fatherhood.
That was firefighting Ed O'Connor speaking to us from Adelaide, Australia. And if you ever have to speak with someone in Adelaide, Australia, don't forget the half hour that you have to add on to the 10-hour time zone if you're in Central European time. You have to add a little half hour onto it.
Is there a personal reason you're mentioning this now? Is it because you
almost
missed the interview with Ed because of the half hour time difference? Yeah, big thanks to Ed there, putting out actual fires in real life and then fires in people's minds or researching the causes of those fires. Gabe, do you remember that period of time? I mean, you've had three, your kids are how old now?
I would have to go back to Ava. Ava's my eldest. We had her in 2012 and I didn't give myself time to think about these questions. I was in survival mode. I functioned. That's it. I got things done. Had my blinders on. I wasn't thinking about myself.
You wouldn't.
I remember a colleague here, actually, Helen Cini, who just retired. At that point, I was working with her, and she said, "Hey, Gabe, you're really handling this father thing so well."
I guess that's my question. Were you?
I don't know. Probably not. I didn't think about it. I didn't have time to think about that. There was too much other stuff going on, taking care of Adrienne, making sure Ava didn't die. I was constantly freaked out that she was going to suffocate or fall or...
Yeah, yeah.
I was only thinking about her. I wasn't thinking about myself.
That's... After we finished talking to Ed, one of the things he said was that when they say 1 out of 10 men, what they mean is at the clinical level. That means somebody who has depressive symptoms that require some sort of action from a doctor, from a therapist, psychologist, whoever.
There are probably so many more.
And just under the surface are many, many more. Based on your experience, my experience, I would be surprised if...
You dealt with sleep deprivation?
I mean, think about sleep deprivation alone. That's enough. If you go weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks with sleep deprivation, your mental health plummets off a cliff. Your physical health, you're not able to exercise. You're reaching for chips and sugar, right? Everything starts... So... there's no single answer to all of these problems because it is just a hard period of your life raising small children. The only advice, based on everything he said, that I possibly have was for us, the best thing we ever did was the babysitter. So in the midst of the chaos, and there were times where we had booked the babysitter and we had a date planned and I was really close to canceling it because I didn't have the energy to go on that date. That's how exhausted it was. Like the date would have been like a movie and I didn't have the energy to go see a movie. Yeah. And then we forced ourselves and it was the thing that helped us the most. That's Connor's tip, kind of connected to what Ed said.
Yeah, and if you are a new dad and you're going through a rough patch, I guess I'm 12 years in at this point, so that period is behind me, but my life has no purpose. Without them.
Oh, okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay. That was an important second part of the sentence.
Without them.
Yeah, I getcha. It's worth going through maybe that's just your brain justifying it after the fact because...
Fine, but that still feels good. Yeah, it still feels good to say that.
Do you have anything to say on fatherhood or motherhood or trying to raise, you know, a couple little gremlins running around knocking things over, spilling their apple juice? Let us know. SU@DW.com.
DW, made for minds.